From the KTOO Newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry. Short-term rental owners in Juneau voiced opposition to a proposed registration program this week. The Juneau Assembly was set to vote on the program at its Monday meeting. But after hearing from operators, they decided it needed more work. Several speakers, like Douglas resident Mary Ann Ray, said the additional paperwork would be onerous.
There's a lot of control in here that is being applied to what ends up being, in most cases, just small mom-and-pop operations.
The program would assign a unique number to each short-term rental unit. Owners would have to include that number in online listings or face a fee. The proposed program did not include registration fees and does not set a limit to the number of short-term rentals allowed in Juneau. But assembly members have started discussing further regulations. Dawn Dulabon has been an Airbnb host since 2019. She said regulating short-term rentals went against efforts to support local businesses.
I live here year-round. I work here year-round. But when the city takes steps to hinder my income, which is necessary to live in such an expensive city, it reminds me of the actions the city has taken to put seasonal people first.
City staff say the program would help them collect sales tax and get better data on Juneau's short-term rental market. Operator Hannah Davis was one of the few speakers who supported it.
If we are lucky enough to own property in this wonderful city, then it is our job to be transparent with the city as well.
Operators suggested the program needed work with more input from the industry. Member Wade Bryson supported the idea.
I think that we can bring this back in a package that the public will understand, that the users will understand and be able to comply with. Let's make sure we get this right.
The assembly voted 5-3 to send the ordinance back to the Committee of the Whole. Sitka's Mount Edgecumbe volcano is coming under closer scrutiny this summer as research teams follow up on the earthquake swarms, which occurred under the mountain in spring of last year. And satellite data shows that the flanks of the peak steadily inflating since about 2018. While no eruption is imminent, scientists from the Alaska Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks recently spent a few days on the flanks of the crater and on surrounding beaches, collecting information which they hope sheds light on what's brewing beneath the surface.
Don't you let go!
You've probably seen it a few times. Gollum and the One Ring have plunged into the lava river at the bottom of Mount Doom, and Samwise is trying to pull Frodo back before he suffers the same fate. Luckily, hobbits have a body chemistry more favorable to heroics inside a volcano. If it had been Aragorn or any of the other human characters in Lord of the Rings helping to destroy the ring, they might have been long gone, passed out in the high concentration of carbon dioxide gas produced in this environment. CO2 can't be smelled or seen, but a team of scientists from the Alaska Geophysical Institute knows how to detect it. Six of them spent a few days helicoptering between Sitka and Mount Edgecumbe in early June, testing the soil of Kruzoff Island for CO2. I caught up with them at the Sitka airport, waiting for a break in the weather.
So today, hopefully, the weather is looking good, so we're hoping to make it to the summit of Edgecumbe today. And we're hoping to measure diffuse CO2, those same CO2 measurements we've been taking along the flanks of the volcano. And then if we could get inside the crater, we'd like to take some measurements there. However, it's unclear if it's snow-free right now.
Claire Puglio is a doctoral student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks under Research Assistant Professor Tarsilo Girona. Girona has a theory that low-temperature thermal anomalies detected by satellite data suggest increased activity in magma that may be a precursor to an eruption. The same CO2 that would make a volcano inhospitable to Aragorn could possibly be warming the flanks of Mount Edgecumbe.
One of the hypotheses we have to understand those signals is that the gas that is moving from the magma source to the surface is producing this warming in the surface.
Girona and Puglio are two of the six members of the team from the Alaska Geophysical Institute studying gas emissions on Mount Edgecumbe. The project is funded by NASA as part of a program for early career scientists. They're tackling the problem on two fronts, in the air and on the land, or better said, in the land. Carlo Cardellini is from the University of Perugia in Italy. He's helped develop the method for collecting gas from the soil using a device called an accumulation chamber. But he's got a slightly more flavorful metaphor.
And we place a chamber on the top of the soil. It's like a cooking pot. And we leave the concentration of carbon dioxide increase inside the chamber. And the rate of increasing is something that is linked to the amount of gas that is passing from the soil to the atmosphere. So we are catching this increase and we can compute how much gas is escaping from the soil.
Cardellini uses an infrared sensor that continuously measures the concentration of CO2 in the cooking pot, if you will. But he also collects samples to take back and study in the lab. CO2 produced by magma will have a different isotopic signature than CO2 produced by organic decomposition. And there is a lot of organic decomposition on the slopes of Mount Edgecombe, which are primarily wetlands. For the bigger picture, you've got to be airborne. Taryn Lopez is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. While the others are sampling the slopes of the crater, she'll be overhead doing what is called a gas flight.
Some gases exsolve, which means they form bubbles really deep, such as CO2, where things like water and SO2, which are common volcanic gases, exsolve very shallow. What we're looking for is the composition of the gases. If we see gases and if we see the composition, we can tell if the magma is deep or shallow.
This is the first morning of several that the team has been in Sitka, that the rim of the Mount Edgecombe crater is visible 3,200 feet above Sitka Sound, and the helicopter pilot is ready to fly. Tarsilo Girona tells me that all the data and information collected by the Geophysical Institute team will be published in several papers and shared with the Alaska Volcano Observatory, which is sending its own team to Mount Edgecombe later this summer. And hopefully, Girona said, we can better understand how the volcano works. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And the first place finishers in the race to Alaska sailed into Ketchikan early Wednesday morning after 5 days and 18 hours on the water. KRBD's Reagan Miller watched from the dock as they rang the finishing bell and has this report.
We Break for Wales's 8-person crew stumbled off the boat just before 6 a.m. with linked arms, murmuring about cookie dough and reminiscing about all the whales they saw. They jumped, hugged, and popped open a bottle of champagne and a few cans of beer and a box of cinnamon rolls. We Break for Wales was the first team to cross the finish line in the storied race that takes competitors from Port Townsend, Washington, through Victoria, British Columbia, and finally to Ketchikan. A small welcome party was waiting for the team with questions, especially about their time near Dixon Entrance, where it was windy with some rough chop. Weather can be a problem when the major rule of the race is no motors.
Did you see like 40 knots like the forecast said? How was it?
Wasn't 40, but we definitely saw 28s.
A little lumpy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The whole boat was catching air and then landing in the troughs.
The team worked with little sleep in the final leg of the journey. They reported gusts around 30 miles an hour the day before they sailed into Ketchikan. This was team member Maisie Bryant's second race. She says there's just something about the weirdest human-powered boat race in Alaska.
I enjoy it. I like the adventure. It's beautiful. It, like, disconnects you from society a little bit and just makes it simpler.
Bryant says the crew had no problems sailing together.
We all had great personalities, super positive. They kept it different. And if someone needed a nap, we always had an extra person, and we were able to keep the boat somewhat organized and the food coming through.
They might not have slept during the last 24 hours of the race, but they did eat.
So we actually pre-cooked and froze dinners. And then for breakfast, we pre-made some burritos, we had some oatmeal, and lunch was kind of like grab-and-go sandwiches. So we ate so well, plus our cookies. Can't forget the cookies.
Nikki Henderson, who hails from the United Kingdom, is another returner. She says she did it again for the adventure.
The race has like an amazing balance of adventure and kind of community and like the sense of freedom and curiosity of not just the world, but also like humankind, I guess, and humanity and the limits to what you can do. And I think like when you're feeling, when life's not super smooth, it's good to get yourself into that environment because it's so empowering, I think, when you do something like that.
And Henderson says the boat really lived up to its name. The crew saw a ton of whales and watched them bubble feed for a long time.
It was like being on David Attenborough or something.
As the first place team, We Break for Whales gets the glory and $10,000, but not the treasured steak knives. That's up for grabs by whichever team makes it in next. As of Wednesday, Team Budgie Smugglers was the next boat due in.
In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
This is KTOO.